Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Who owns the rights to a play, a song, or a work of art? How important and fragile is authorship? These and other issues of intellectual property rights begin to be revealed in Errors and Omissions, a novel by Stanford Law professor Paul Goldstein. Errors and Omissions follows the story of attorney Michael Seeley as he locates a World War II era Polish refugee who's the author of a screenplay that has the potential to make a huge amount of money, not only from the movie, but also from the sale of paraphernalia associated with the movie. Goldstein, who began writing fiction at the age of 12, and now 50 years later with his first novel, hopes that the reader will carry away the sense of fragility of authorship when an artist creates a work out of thin air. I spoke with Professor Paul Goldstein from his office at Stanford University Law School in early August 2006 and began by asking him to define intellectual property law.
Intellectual property law, think of real property law, you know, the land you may own or the personal property, the car you may own. You have rights to stop anybody from coming on your land or borrowing your car without permission. Intellectual property law is much the same, except its object is information. It could be entertainment like a motion picture. It could be an invention like Lipitor, the drug. It's information about how to do things or plots, stories, characters, like Errors and Omissions, that are protected by property rights.
Some people choose to use other people's ideas. And how does the law structure that protection?
Well, in much the same way, although it's a lot more porous than real property law, but it's much much the same phenomenon. You know, in the event of an emergency, nobody can walk across your front lawn without your permission. But in the event of an emergency, somebody is escaping from a car making its way down the street at a high rate of speed, they would be entitled to cross your property without your permission. By the same token, we say that copyrighted works, for example, are subject to a fair use defense. Again, I say it's much more porous because it's information that's involved and free speech interests that are involved than is real property. But there are lots of uses that other people can make of this, radio interview, for example, without your permission in the larger public interest.
So you've put this into a book, Errors and Omissions, with Michael Seeley, a lawyer who has trouble with drink, passionate about protecting the rights of the creator, of the author. Tell us about the story.
As you say, he is passionate about protecting the author, I think in large part because he's passionate about representing and protecting the underdog, and authors so often in our society are the underdog. What happens is, as you say, his career, he was once one of the most highly reputed intellectual property lawyers in the country. His career is on the ropes. Drink has just plunged him to a professional bottom, to a personal bottom. He's facing possible disbarment as a result of his misbehavior in a judge's chambers. And a motion picture studio in Hollywood that he's done work for before takes advantage of his current plight to try to get him to represent to it that it owns the rights to a major property, the basis for a $1 billion franchise like the James Bond motion picture franchise, whose rights really are in doubt. And Seeley is faced with a very hard choice between doing what they want as a vehicle to keeping his license to practice law and being able to continue representing the underdog, and on the other hand, being true to his principles that you state the law as it is, and you don't cut any corners. That's a conflict in Errors and Omissions that brings Seeley into a search for authorship of the book, brings him through the blacklist period. Although it's a contemporary novel, it has to look back to the blacklist period and then the Holocaust in Europe, in finding a way to state the truth, keep his license to practice law if he can.
So in the story, we have the purported author, and we have somebody else who is the real author, and we have the mogul of the movie studio,
Mayor Berman,
who seems to step on anybody and anything for his own benefit.
Absolutely, a tyrant.
So tell us about how you've put these together. You've woven in these characters.
Well, a lot of it is taken from my experiences in real life. I've a lot of the milieu, the venues that you see here, lunches in a motion picture studio, commissary, these are places I've been. Discussions with the general counsels of major motion picture studios. These are discussions I've had. And while having these discussions and being in these meetings on behalf of clients, I've always been one who watches what's going on and taking mental notes, if not written notes. And the personalities in Hollywood are so large, so strong, it's really impossible not to take note of them. And then to ask that big question that I think is at the beginning of any novel, what if these issues came to the fore? What if this personality clashed with that personality? Would there be a drama there? And I like to think that I did find a real drama in this story.
The personality clash, can you describe it?
Well, take the personality clash between Mayor Berman and his son-in-law, who's the president of the studio, and compare it to the clash between Berman and Seeley. When Berman is dealing with his son-in-law, for whom he has absolutely no respect, and there is a major power play going on at the studio between him and his son-in-law, you have a clash of someone who is the son-in-law truly envious of the power that this tyrant is wielding over him. And will do anything to circumvent that power, but complete disrespect on the part of the mogul, Mayor Berman, toward him. You compare that with the real clash of intellects between Mayor Berman, who is very, very smart and a real survivor, and Michael Seeley, who for all of his dissolution that he's trying to overcome, he's trying desperately to stop drinking, is a very smart guy. He's one smart cookie. And Berman realizes that he's dealing here with an equal, which is something he doesn't often encounter. And it's that battle between equals, one shrewder than the other in some context, one braver than the other, that really makes for a lot of the drama, particularly toward the latter part of the book.
Paul Goldstein, author of Errors and Omissions. What prompted you to write Errors and Omissions?
Well, I have been writing about law in a professional way for close to 40 years now. Before I did that, I was a very active fiction writer. Starting at age 12, I've been writing stories, writing little plays, writing poetry. Dropped that when I got into law. But, it's a thread by the side of the road that was just waiting to be picked up again. And a couple of things happened in the late 1990s. One is I wrote a book that I was having a passionate love affair with the law of copyright for all of 30 years and decided it was about time to explain this passion to the general reader, which I did in a little book called Copyright's Highway. It's a nonfiction book. It's been very successful. And it tells the story, the past and the future of copyright. And I found that I enjoyed the challenge of conveying law, legal principles, in a dramatic way, in an engaging way, but also an accurate way. So that was one thing. I got a review in Publishers Weekly that was very positive, and they talked about one of the chapters in the book, and they said of it, improbably it reads like a legal thriller. And this is about a Supreme Court case. And I said, wow, yeah, maybe I can do that. And then I worked on a case a couple of years later that involved the James Bond franchise, rights to it. And the legal issues were somewhat different from those in Errors and Omissions. But I said, you know, what if the legal issues were a little bit different? And the rights to a multi-billion dollar motion picture franchise turned on some narrow interpretation of law, getting one person's signature on an assignment of rights rather than another's. See, that could have the makings of a story. So there's those two things, the realization that I could do it and a subject matter that just blossomed into a drama, taken together with the, you know, that thread in my life of liking to write fiction and being able to pick that up once again.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Professor Paul Goldstein, who teaches at the Stanford Law School in Palo Alto, California, about his book, Errors and Omissions, a novel about intellectual property rights and who wrote what. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Paul Goldstein, tell us about the process, how long it took to write Errors and Omissions, and how you changed throughout that process.
Well, that's an interesting question, Barry. Let me take the easy one first. It was a 5-year process, although in a sense I could say it took me, you know, 35, 40 years to write it, because there's an awful lot of my experience as a lawyer in there. But the actual pencil to paper and revising draft after draft was a 5-year process. One change that occurred as a result, I've always been a huge fiction reader, I just love reading fiction, always have, was an increase in my respect for people who write fiction. It's not as easy as might appear from reading, you know, wonderfully simple stories. One could say, well, gee, I could do that. Well, for me at least, it took a lot of effort. One thing I had overlooked is the extent to which, as a writer, I think other writers have to do this as well, as a writer of fiction, you're making judgments at every sentence you write. I mean, I'm accustomed to making judgments in my law practice and my law teaching, but these are judgments that are unbounded. You know, should this character move this way or that way? What should his relationship with a love interest in the book, Julia, B, should it take this turn or that turn? What will its implications be for the rest of the story? You know, should I introduce a flesh-eating plant at some point in the story? As you know, there are no flesh-eating plants in the story. But, you know, a fiction writer has the entire world of possibility open on the page, and making those decisions about what you think works and what won't was an eye-opener for me.
Did you feel any personal change in your own approach to life as a result of producing and writing Errors and Omissions?
Honestly, no. I don't think it altered my outlook on life particularly. Now, perhaps the more studied answer would be, ask me that question 5 years from now, and I'll say, you know, there was a radical change in my outlook on life, that just that I was not aware of it at the time. That's the kind of thing that I think comes slowly. This book was just published a couple of weeks ago.
So if there's one thing that you would like your readers to carry away from having read Errors and Omissions, what would that be?
I hope that they'll carry away a sense of the importance and fragility of authorship. This is something that for Michael Seeley, the main character, the central character of Errors and Omissions, is his mission in life to protect authors. And you say, well, why? You know, why choose that rather than, you know, some other possible pursuit? You know, authorship, and by that I mean not just people who write screenplays, as in this case, or novels, but people who paint, people who create musical works. These people are crafting out of thin air the objects and elements that add interest and depth and texture to our lives. And they are to be cherished for that reason. And the law is there, itself a fragile vessel for protecting it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And Seeley's quest for the author, as you described it, of this screenplay in the novel, ultimately becomes a quest for his own individuality, his own personality, his own redemption. And that's something that comes to him piece by piece.
So how much of Michael Seeley is Paul Goldstein?
Well, yeah, there's a common observation that people make when they'll look at a novel that has a central figure like Michael Seeley and say, well, how much of the author is in him? Very often in my experience, and this is another thing I've learned from writing, is that the main aspects of the author often show up in other characters than the main character. There is, for example, a character in the book, Bert Cobb, the old photographer out in Pacoima, California, whom I identify with very closely, I will confess to you. There is a lot of me in Bert Cobb, this crusty old photographer. Photography is my hobby. But there's probably more of me in Bert Cobb than there is in Michael Seeley. What I share with Seeley is a skepticism about the wisdom of authority. We both have a very strong skepticism in that way, a certain amount of idealism, a respect for authors. At the same time, he's a lot braver than I am, and he's a lot smarter than I am.
Yet you created him.
Yeah, but that's the funny thing about creating someone. He can have comebacks that I will think about 5 minutes later and saying, I wish I had that comeback. Well, we have the luxury of that 5 minutes in writing the character and his dialogue to think that one up. He's a lot smarter than I am, trust me.
Okay. You mentioned something earlier when in your description of copyright law and intellectual property law, and you talked about comparing it to property law.
Yeah.
In property law, as many people know, if someone walks across another person's yard for 5 years, they develop the right of use, the prescriptive easement.
That's right.
But that doesn't exist in intellectual law.
Well, it does in a different way. You're quite right. There is no such thing as a prescriptive easement, or even adverse possession is a related term in intellectual property law. But there are notions of abandonment that if a it's hard to show. It's much harder to show. If a copyright owner abandons her rights in a work, anybody can use them. If over time people have been, just take the World Wide Web, people are regularly downloading from your website, pages from your website. If that continually happens without you objecting to it, over time, people will be held to enjoy what's called an implied license to do it, notwithstanding that you haven't done anything about it, entered into an express license with them. It will be held that there's an implied license. But on the fundamental point, you're absolutely right, and the reason for it is this. When you have a couple of acres of land, it's there, and if somebody's trespassing on it, you know about it, and you could stop them. And if you don't stop them, it's sort of like an implied license that they can continue doing it. In the case of intellectual property, this is any form, copyright, patent, even trademark, these interests exist worldwide. And how do you possibly know, how can you possibly know whether somebody in East Africa is copying off your website right now? If someone in France is whistling a tune that you composed, because the subject matter is information and entertainment and ideas, that has this global spread, there's no way you can effectively police it. And for that reason, we're going to say, well, the fact that you couldn't police it, unlike your piece of land, means you're not going to be held to have forfeited your rights by not stopping people from trespassing.
The distant, semi-anonymous use of someone else's work is what you're referring to.
Exactly.
And in some cases, and you make reference to it in Errors and Omissions, this is money-driven. You make reference particularly in terms of Mayer Berman. Mayer or Meyer?
He pronounces it Mayer. His name was originally Meyer, and he changed it to Mayer. He thought it sounded a little bit more Teutonic and more fitting for a man of his stature.
You make reference to Wall Street driving a lot of what his movie industry does.
That's right.
How real is that now?
Right now, I think it's not Wall Street so much anymore, except to the extent these are publicly owned companies that are that own the studios, and they are driven by stock price and shareholders and Wall Street. In the days when Mayer Berman was getting his start, the days of the blacklist, Wall Street, you know, quite specifically in figures like Joseph Kennedy, for example, had a direct role in manipulating the studios. And I think, you know, the common denominator between that period and the present is, like it or not, and I don't necessarily dislike it, money is what drives the production of popular art. It costs, you know, $80 million to produce a, you know, major feature-length motion picture, at least. And that $80 million has to come from somewhere. And it's not, you know, a writer scribbling a screenplay in a garret, which is very valuable and important, and the screenwriter needs to put food on the table. But it takes, you know, tens of millions of dollars to put this in shape, to bring it to the larger public, which presumably the hope is will repay that investment.
And thus the importance of getting the proper signatures, the proper loans, and the proper insurance.
Absolutely right.
Is a thread in Errors and Omissions.
Exactly. That's really the triggering instance is, this company can't make, the United Pictures, Mayer Berman Studio, can't make the next installment of Spy Killer, the motion picture franchise, without getting $80 million from a bank. And the bank says, we're not going to give you $80 million unless an insurance company, you know, will insure our ownership of it in the event the studio goes bust. And the insurance company says, well, we want to see some evidence that you really do own it before we issue an insurance policy. And so on the signature of one person turns the willingness of major financial institutions to support an investment in a motion picture.
And it becomes a signature chase in Errors and Omissions.
Classic paper chase, a signature chase, absolutely.
Well, Paul Goldstein, in the flyleaf of your book, Errors and Omissions, it says that you've been regularly included in Best Lawyers in America. What are the standards to be included in that? I might be interested someday.
Okay. You know, I don't know exactly what the standards are. I do know, you know, how they go about compiling it, because I do receive a questionnaire from the publishers periodically. My experience of it is that they circulate questionnaires among lawyers working in your particular field. And so I'm in Best Lawyers in America under intellectual property, and they'll have other specialties as well. And as I understand it, they will canvass other intellectual property lawyers to nominate people who they think are at their top of the field, and they'll list names sometimes, and you'll rate them. I think it's on an A through C scale. I forget what the scale was. And so it's basically peer review.
Many people dislike lawyers. We're the butt of many jokes. People are uncomfortable around lawyers sometimes. Where do you think that emanates from? We're just regular guys.
Well, we can say, Barry, that you and I are regular guys, and I don't actually know where that comes from. I certainly, you know, I know the jokes, and I've been in situations where people would say, well, you're one of the good ones, but let me tell you what lawyers are like. And obviously, as in any profession, there are, you know, fine lawyers, and there are lawyers who are not so fine. The real question is, Why do people seize on their experiences or what they hear about the lawyers who aren't up to par to take them as representative of lawyers generally? We don't do that with accountants that I know of, and I don't think we do that with physicians. And the question is why. So really, it's an interesting question to which I haven't a clue of an answer.
Is that something that you pose to your law students?
No, it's not anything we talk about. I go into a classroom on the premise that this is, and I know it sounds a little bit flowery, this is a noble and worthy profession. And I just operate on that premise. This is a great profession. We solve problems for people that they cannot solve for themselves. And I think that's pretty good.
And in learning to do that, we study how problems have been solved in the past. And in some of the work that I do, we learn those resolutions and apply them to the evolving situation to try and avoid or sidetrack those problems.
Exactly.
Well, Paul Goldstein, author of Errors and Omissions, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah, I haven't quite finished it, but it's probably the most interesting book I've read in a while, and it's nonfiction for a change. It's a book called Aspects of the Novel by E.M. Forster. It's a series of lectures he gave in Cambridge in 1927. It was a gift to me. I'm embarrassed to say I was not aware of it. I'd read some of Forster's novels, Howard's End is one. But a good friend of mine, who's a retired English school teacher in the Palo Alto system, gave it to me as a gift to celebrate the publication of Errors and Omissions. And it is a wonderfully clear-eyed view of the novel. You know, here, take a master novelist, E.M. Forster, a very, very smart guy, and just who writes and speaks just beautifully, in very simple, focused, smart terms, describes the elements of the novel and how they interrelate. And it says, you know, here's something I've been working at for the past 5-6 years, and I'm working on the second one now, yet in the midst of it, have not had the opportunity to step back and say, these are the elements of it. This is what I've been doing. This is the craft. And to have a master like E.M. Forster put it all down in crystal clear, engaging terms, it's just a wonderful, riveting read, has just been a delight.
Professor Paul Goldstein, author of Errors and Omissions, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
Barry, thanks very much for having me.
Paul Goldstein is a professor of law at Stanford University Law School and the author of Errors and Omissions, a story about the ownership of intellectual property rights. The book he recommends is Aspects of the Novel by E.M. Forster. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.